2. Pietists versus Liturgicals, the political party constituencies. In 1970, in a brilliant and seminal work titled The Cross of Culture, A Social Analysis of Midwestern Politics, 1850-1900, Professor Paul Kleppner provided a cogent and illuminating explanation for the constituencies of the third-party systems. It is a thesis since amply confirmed by other historians. The thesis explains not only which groups tended to support which parties, but also the specific process by which that support was generated and strengthened. Briefly, the Kleppner thesis holds that pietist religious groups tended A. to favour statism, both in the personal and the economic spheres, and B. therefore consistently supported the Republicans as the statist party, while the liturgicals, consisting largely of Catholics and conservative Lutherans, A. favoured liberty, both in the personal and economic spheres, and B. therefore supported the Democrats as the libertarian party. Kleppner, indeed, in examining detailed voting and religious records for the Midwestern states, breaks down Lutherans and other Protestant groups into varying degrees of pietism and liturgicalism, and is able to show a one-to-one correlation between the degree of commitment to the liturgical outlook and the degree of voting support to the Democratic Party. The great exception to this correlation, of course, was the South, overwhelmingly pietist, and yet which voted Democratic because of the special circumstances, memories, and consequences of the Civil War. The genesis of these differing world outlooks Kleppner analyses as beginning with basic theology. The pietists were those who held that each individual, rather than the church or the clergy, was responsible for his own salvation. Salvation was a matter not of following prescribed ritual, or even of cleaving to a certain fixed creed, but rather of an intense emotional commitment or conversion experience by the individual, even to the extent of believing himself born again in a special baptism of grace. Moreover, the outward sign, the evidence to the rest of society for the genuineness and the permanence of a given individual's conversion, was his continuing purity of behaviour. And since each individual was responsible for his own salvation, the pietists concluded that society was duty-bound to aid each man in pursuing his salvation, in promoting his good behaviour, and in seeing as best it could that he does not fall prey to temptation. The emphasis of the pietists was on converting the maximum number of persons, and in helping them to become and to remain sound. Society, therefore, in the institution of the state, was to take it upon itself to aid the weaker brethren, by various crusading actions of compulsory morality, and thus to purge the world of sin. The secular and the religious were to be conjoined. In the second half of the 19th century, the pietists concentrated on agitating for three such compulsory measures on the state and local level, to save liturgical sinners despite themselves. Prohibition to eradicate the sin of alcohol. Sunday blue laws to prevent people from violating the Sabbath. And, increasingly toward the end of the century, compulsory public schooling to Americanize the immigrants and Christianize the Catholics, and to use the schools to transform Catholics and immigrants, often one and the same, into pietistic, Protestant and nativist moulds. The pietists then typically concentrated on the purity and propriety of each individual's behaviour. They were not particularly interested in creed or formal theology, and since the emphasis was each individual's direct confrontation with Christ, they were not particularly concerned with which specific church the person might join. The typical pietist, therefore, switched denominations with relative ease. The pietists consequently went heavily for numerous interdenominational societies for social reform, the prohibition drives being a good case in point. Editor's footnote. Rothbard would later expand on this thesis using eschatology, the doctrine of last things, and describe the religious interventionists as Yankee post-millennial pietists, who were evangelized through the frenzied revivals of Reverend Charles Grandison Finney during the Second Great Awakening of the late 1820s. They were a group of pietist English descendants that lived in rural New England, upstate New York, northern Ohio, northern Indiana, and northern Illinois, who were post-millennialist in that they believed the world must be improved for 1,000 years before Jesus would return to usher in the end of history. In order to bring about this kingdom of God, the post-millennial pietists took it as their moral duty to stamp out the sin of others, even if it required the coercive hand of government. Over time, these crusaders lost their religious zeal and became secularized, but still maintained their enthusiasm for wielding state force. End footnote. The liturgicals, on the other hand, largely Catholics and German Lutherans and also Anglicans, had a very different theological and moral outlook. For the liturgical, the path towards salvation was in the hands of the church and its priests, and what the individual needed to do was to believe in and practice the prescribed ritual. Given these intellectual rather than emotional beliefs and those rituals, the individual church member need not worry continually over his own salvation. And as far as the salvation of his fellow citizens, that could be accomplished, insofar as was possible, if they joined the church. The church, rather than the state, then, was in charge of morality and salvation, and hence the state need and should have nothing to do with moral and theological matters. As Professor Jensen, whose studies of the Middle West have confirmed Kleppner's findings, has put it, quote, "For the liturgical, the church itself would attend to all matters of morality and salvation. Hence the state had no right to assert a role in delineating public morality." End quote. The liturgical was also rather sensibly puzzled over the intense hostility of the pietists toward alcohol, especially when Jesus himself had drunk wine. "We do not believe in making sin what God made not sin," was a typical liturgical response. To the liturgical, sin was not such impure behaviour as drinking alcohol, but heresy and refusal to believe the theological creed of the church or to obey its prescribed ritual. As Jensen summarised the difference, the Methodists expelled members for impure behaviour, the liturgicals for heresy. It was quite clear, moreover, that such theological matters as heresy and liturgy could hardly be considered matters for state intervention and enforcement. It should be noted that while liturgicals consisted mainly of such groups as Catholics and Lutherans, they also included some sects, such as Orthodox Calvinists, who emphasized creed rather than ritual, and so could not in the strict sense be called liturgical. Their attitude toward the vital importance of the particular church and of correct belief was similar, however, and this set them apart from the pietistic Protestants. Such groups included the old school Presbyterians and a few groups of Baptists. The liturgical correctly perceived the pietist as the persistent, hectoring busybody and aggressor, hell-bent to deprive him of his Sunday beer and his voluntarily supported parochial schools, so necessary to preserve and transmit his religion and his values. While the pietist was a pestiferous crusader, the liturgical wanted nothing so much as to be left alone. It is no wonder that the Republican Party, the party of the pietists, the party that catered to prohibitionists, blue law agitators, and compulsory public school advocates, was known throughout this period as the party of great moral ideas. While the Democrats, the party of the liturgicals, the party deeply opposed to compulsory morality, were known as the party of personal liberty. Footnote. We are not trying to claim any apodictic certainty for these causal connections. That is, it is perfectly possible to have pietists who are consistent libertarians, or who are inconsistent between personal and economic liberty. And it is perfectly possible to have liturgicals who are statists, or who are inconsistent. All we are claiming is that this is what the contrasting religious groups in America in the late 19th century believed, and that this is how their belief system originated and developed. We are not making any similar claims for any other time or place in world history. It should be noted, however, that the leadership on behalf of economic freedom and individual liberty taken by the British Pietists in the 18th and 19th centuries, as well as earlier, may be a bit deceiving. For these dissenters or nonconformists were reacting against an established Anglican liturgical church, and they would naturally favour religious liberty when confronting a state in opposition hands. It should also be pointed out that British liberalism in that era was continually being split by the penchant of the nonconformist masses to be A, in favour of prohibition, and B, in favour of crushing the Irish Catholics. In that way, the Liberal Party's devotion to individual liberty was repeatedly undercut and compromised. End footnote. To a late 20th century observer, one of the most puzzling things about 19th century party politics is the enormous amount of interest and passion spent on economic issues. Professors who can scarcely interest their own students in economic matters must marvel at presidential campaigns at which such esoteric matters as protective tariffs, central banking, and gold and silver standards were intense objects of general public attention and partisan debate. How did the mass of the public get interested in such arcane matters? The Kleppner analysis explains this enigma. The interest and passions of both party constituencies were first engaged on the religious cultural, the gut local level. The constant prods were such issues as liquor, blue laws and the public schools. Then, with partisan passions engaged on the local and religious level, the leaders and ideologists of both parties were able to widen the consciousness of their respective constituencies, to brilliantly link up the local with the national, the personal with the economic. Thus, the Republican leaders would tell their Pietist constituents, "You believe in strong state and local governments to protect the morals of the public. In the same way, you should favour strong federal government to protect Americans from cheap foreign competition, to expand their purchasing power through plentiful money and cheap credit, through greenbacks, government control of the banking system, or free silver, government subsidies to business, and large-scale public works expenditures." At the same time, the Democratic leaders would tell their liturgical constituents, "You know that the Pietists are determined to deprive you of your wholesome pleasures, such as beer and Sunday sports, in the name of their own peculiar version of morality. They are trying to take away your parochial schools." Now, the same Pietists, the same Republicans, who are nagging and oppressing you on the state level, are also trying to interfere with your liberty and property on the federal level. They are trying to expand their local moral paternalism to national economic paternalism. They are trying to tax you to subsidise privileged interests. They are trying to keep you from consuming cheap foreign products. And they are trying to deprive you of the fruits of your thrift and savings through cheap money and inflation. In short, both parties were able to link up statism and big government in Washington and at home, to connect the economic and the personal. The Republicans, the party of statism, lined up squarely against the Democrats, the party of liberty. Editor's footnote. The post-Civil War laissez-faire and hard-money Democrats were known as the Bourbons. They were generally centred in the Northeast, but were also in the Midwest. On the other hand, there were the much more statist and inflationist, populist Democrats based in the South and Far West. The Democratic upheaval in 1896 refers to the populist faction defeating the Bourbon democracy and transforming the party from one that championed laissez-faire to one that was much more supportive of government intervention. End footnote. In those decades, there was continuing drift of both parties from the centre, no deliberate fuzzing of the issues and of all differences. On the contrary, the differences were emphasised in order to appeal to the respective constituencies and to keep their interest fired up. Many historians have concluded that throughout most of the 19th century, there was an anti-immigrant animus by native-born Americans, and that the Democrats became the immigrant-based party while the Republicans attracted the nativists. But Kleppner shows that the basic division was not really between native-born and immigrants, or between English-speaking and foreigners. Pietistic Scandinavian immigrants, for example, identified with the native WASPs very quickly and readily voted Republican. The real division was pietist versus liturgical, and it so happened that the bulk of immigrants were indeed liturgicals, so as to make these immigrants a made-to-order target for pietist bigotry. Restricting immigration would almost certainly hit far more severely at liturgicals, and hence benefit the Republican Party. The emergence of different forms of the Christian religion as the key to political conflicts lends an ironic twist to American history. For twice in the history of America, Christianity had virtually died out. The first time was in the early decades of the 18th century, when Calvinism had given way to the new Enlightenment trends of liberalism and rationalism. But Orthodox Christianity revived in the 1730s and 1740s with the Great Awakening, a new form of pietist Christianity which swept the colonies through the revivalist and evangelical methods of intensely emotional and frenzied conversions. But then, late in the 18th century, Christianity began to die once more, to be replaced by the rationalist deism of the Enlightenment. By the time the United States was founded, it was clear that Christianity was giving way across the board, among the upper classes and among the general public. For the second time, however, Christianity made a remarkable comeback, and once again through a series of frenzied revivals that took place throughout the country in the 1820s and 1830s. These revivals, of course, were necessarily pietist, and pietism's emotional and crusading tone and thrust began with this final upsurge of the early 19th century. Apart from a few Anglicans, there had been very few liturgicals in the America of the 1790s. Essentially, native WASPs were pietist. The ranks of the liturgicals were to be fed during the 19th century by Catholic and Lutheran immigrants from Europe. From the beginning of the revival movement in the 1820s, the resurrected pietists began to form organisations to root out sin among their fellow men. Their two dominant concerns were the sins of slavery and of alcohol. At first, the idea was to ban the saloon, presumably the central iniquity in the dissemination of alcohol. By the late 1830s, the pietists had escalated their demands to include total abstinence and total prohibition, including wine and beer, as well as hard liquor. In 1851, the pietists began to succeed, getting liquor totally banned in Maine. This step was followed by numerous other prohibition laws or constitutional amendments in 12 states during the early 1850s. After 1855, however, the pietists temporarily abandoned their prohibitionist crusade to concentrate on slavery. After the Civil War, the pietists were able to devote all their energies to the evils of alcohol. In 1868, the pietistic prohibitionists founded a secret society, the Good Templars, which soon had 400,000 members. In Michigan in the following year, the Templars helped form the Prohibitionist Party. The foundation of the Women's Christian Temperance Union followed in 1874. By the 1880s, prohibition had become the leading political issue in the Middle West and in most of the rest of the country.